We have a new format that we're kicking off in 2022 called Back on the Block, where we explore some of the ideas that we have had on the Chopping Block and other activist short campaigns that may have come out outside of the Chopping Block, because as we learned anything in 2021, the story does not stop after the report comes out. For the inaugural episode, we've got Carson Block of Muddy Waters Capital. Carson, thank you so much for coming back on.
Hey, Max. Good to see you and Happy New Year.
Well, I know we have one idea that we had on the Chopping Block previously, and then one idea which you released, but that actually never made it onto the Chopping Block. I want to start out with the one that our viewers are familiar with, and that's Beike and the Chinese real estate platform, actually the last company that we discussed on the Chopping Block. It came out not too long ago, back in December, I think about mid-month. We're now a little bit of the way into January in 2022. What sort of updates do you have for us?
Well, one of the things that happened following our report is the company issued its requisite statement saying that we don't understand China and we don't understand its business. But that's been happening for, almost 12 years now. We're about to hit, I'd say we're 6 months away from hitting the 12th anniversary of my not understanding China or the myriad businesses in China that were subsequently delisted after we published on them. So we got that release from it. Now, not really substantively, but I guess on a relative basis, substantively, Beike asserted that we screwed up with our data in our data collection, that there are more agents that are actually on its platform. If you go back to our report, we said, hey, overstating the number of agents by roughly 25%, overstating the number of stores by roughly 25%, overstating the gross transaction value of new homes by about 125%, overstating revenue somewhere in the 75 to 90% range. Beike came back and said, well, you didn't get all the agents because they're in these hidden parts of the platform, right? Well, the platform is a consumer-facing tool that helps real estate buyers or sellers connect with agents. So that's a little bit of an odd claim. But what then seemed to support the company for some people who were paying attention, there were two data analytics providers that spoke with Chinese media. And they said, hey, we've been collecting data on Beike for a while. And per our latest data collections, we actually do come out with numbers of agents and stores that roughly match what Beike has disclosed publicly. There were some people who came at us, saying, oh, they destroyed your thesis. I remember seeing one tweet like that on my feed. But we spoke with one of the analytics providers. And after speaking with that analytics provider, I mean, we're not concerned about our thesis. In fact, we think both we and they can be correct. Here's why. They're not answering the question of, is the company faking data? Okay, they're asking the question, does data exist somewhere on the site? Now, remember that Beike, being a publicly traded company, especially one from China, where there are always questions about the integrity of the financials and the statements the companies make, they're going to know that there are data providers or analytics companies scraping their site. So if you're going to make up agents and make up transactions and stores, well, you need to do that or else somewhere on your website, or else these guys will blow you up. Now, what the analytics provider that we spoke to admitted that using our approach, which we approached it, we got our data in what we call the workflow approach. This is how a user would use the site and what would be visible to them under every permutation that we can think of, and also what's in the source code behind the pages that the user actually interacts with. So that approach is the approach we took, where we're saying, okay, the real business of this company, okay, we're going to count the agents, identify and count the agents that are on the platform as far as at least the platform, the platform's purpose, or when as the platform fulfills its purpose, workflow. Now, what the analytics companies do is they're collecting data from anywhere and everywhere on the site, including indexes. And so if you're Beike and you know that there are going to be analytics providers collecting this data, you want to enter a bunch of false data and you want to do it in a batch way that makes it relatively easy and straightforward for you to enter that data. Muddy Waters' workflow approach will not pick that up. We will not count that data. That's the way that both these analytics providers can be correct, that there's data there saying that they're blah agents that roughly matches what they disclose, but we can be correct saying that there's an overstatement of agents, because where the agent should be, the way that the consumers interact with the platform, the way that the platform fulfills its raison d'etre, that shows this delta, this overstatement of, I think, 26% between the number of agents on it and then that use it. Now, I would also go, we go, of course, a lot deeper than that, because the second leg of our thesis is when we dig into the actual agents and stores on the platform, a lot of them appear to not actually exist or to really be on the platform. Now, that's something that the analytics providers, of course, are not doing. So their statements refer just to this top level analysis. Beyond that, what Beike has done now is they've made the workflow approach impossible to recreate. Like, shocker, that's what GSX did as soon as we published. They made it impossible to collect data the same way, and YY did as well. So, you know, it seems to me that if you're a company that's not lying and thinks that Muddy Waters made mistakes, that you're not going to take these data points off the website in the aftermath of our report. But, you know, I guess one way of putting it is they sure do have that guilty kind of look to me.
So there's the issue with the platform model not really matching up with the idea of having hidden agents. There's the idea that just simply scraping the data doesn't confirm the on-the-ground research that you guys did to determine whether these agents were legitimate. And then also the indexing, were you able to confirm the batch nature of a lot of these index data that the data analytics providers were able to find, that it looked like it had been inputted in that bulk fashion?
So after we had the conversation, we found the index files that we believe they collect data from. But I mean, we can't tell how or when these were entered. But the problem you would face if you're Beike is that if you have too many fake agents, then that's the sort of thing that can get out. I mean, they do have a lot of fake agents as it is. And so, but I also imagine we've seen this all the time throughout 12 years of looking at frauds. You know, most companies take shortcuts somewhere when they're inventing a lot of information or facts or a lot of their financials. The vast majority that we've seen do take some shortcuts somewhere. And that's what we think the data analytics providers, they're capturing the shortcuts. You know, we're looking at that workflow approach. But again, when we spot checked some of the data going to different cities or trying to figure out if these stores existed or agents existed, a lot of times, no, they did not. So even what we collected through the workflow approach, we think significantly overstates the extent of the business.
All right. So this is a position you are not unfamiliar with. Company refutes your claims. They shut off your ability to get to this data. And the market, at least in the short term, seems to side with the company. When you think about a company that you have a strong conviction that they are fraudulent and they are misrepresenting their data, what does the playbook look like from this position?
Look, we've seen, and the playbook has changed over the years, but when we've seen, you know, ever since, I'd say 2020 was a real break in terms of how market behaved for activist shorts beforehand and, you know, and going forward, especially for China-based frauds. And so we saw with GSX what appears to be a lot of manipulation, and eventually it collapsed. With YY, I'd say YY is more analogous to this. I doubt that there's a person out there with $100 billion balance sheet that's massively long this thing and contributing to a squeeze. But Yeah, we see a level of denial, and I think there's also on the China side, there's, you know, this sense of like, okay, you know, retail investors band together against the evil foreigner. You know, at the end of the day, I mean, most frauds do collapse. Some get lucky and get acquired. Others somehow just, you know, they're able to acquire real businesses and fold them in. Yeah, as far as Baycook goes, I mean, you know, as far like my perspective is, the odds overwhelmingly favor a scenario where the stock price declines significantly, and we just have to keep the scrutiny on the company and the pressure.
Well, Baycook, at least it kind of yo-yoed around there around the time of the report, going from up a little bit to down a little bit. As of last week's close, the first week in January, it looks like it was up about 10%. It was the best of times and the worst of times, because the next idea we're going to talk about seemed to shoot up. But since then, Danimer Scientific has really plummeted at the end of 2021 and into 2022. This is the one that, just because we actually had another idea coming out on the chopping block, we didn't want to have too many things coming out, and we didn't do one. But you still went to market with the report in September of 2021. Since then, you've had the response from management, and the share price has declined significantly. You know, what has happened? I think this one's a little bit more important to go over the original thesis, seeing as we haven't shared it with viewers.
So Danimer Scientific, and I want to point out, we closed out our short at the very end of last year. So it declined a significant amount. It's not to say we don't think it can decline further, but you know, we felt that a lot of thesis had, well, maybe thesis hadn't played out, but there was a significant sell-off in a relatively short period of time. So we were happy with that. Danimer, we were not the first short activists to publish on Danimer. The first was Spruce Point. And that followed a Wall Street Journal article that questioned whether its bioplastics are really that biodegradable. Our issue with Danimer was that Danimer's bull case rests in large part on these $200 million worth of offtake agreements that they claim to have. And when they went public by SPAC at the end of 2020, the CEO, Steve Krosky, was actually saying, you know, hey, all we need to do is build capacity and then we can start fulfilling these offtake agreements.
We've always kind of taken a stepladder approach to financing. And we launched the Holy Grail of Plastic in March. And 2 days later, the COVID shutdown came. So that kind of blew up our expansion plans from a financing standpoint. Even though we were sitting on over $200 million in take or pay offtake agreements, and we had customers like PepsiCo, Nestle, Bacardi, you know, expecting us to be able to grow our capacity. So we had to find a way to find a lot of cash fast. And that's what we did.
We felt that that was very misrepresentative, that calling these offtake agreements was really misrepresentative of where the business is and what these agreements are. I mean, the agreements they've signed are contingent upon the company being able to produce the product. From what we were able to discern doing analysis of the financials, I mean, the company was not, its production has been anemic. And it seems like it was hung up with a bunch of finished goods inventory. And so at the end of Q2, and we looked at this and we said, you know, these statements that you can sell everything as soon as you make it are completely belied by the existence of this finished goods inventory. But, you know, we found that the partners, these offtake agreements, understand that it's really speculative as to whether Danimer will be able to develop the product. So Danimer had implied strongly that there was no real product development issue in many of these cases. It just needed the capacity. Now, the other thing that we looked at, and Danimer had been telling the market that it would be producing at 50% of nameplate capacity, its PHA at 50% of nameplate capacity in the first half. Well, when we calced it out, they were actually really only at about 25% of nameplate capacity. That's the one thing that Danimer actually substantively responded to. They said, oh, no. When we talk about nameplate capacity for PHA, you know, we're measuring the PHA with all of the fillers and other additives that go into a blend. So we're talking tons of blended product. We wondered following that, and I'll give credit to Danimer. We then engaged them openly as Muddy Waters, and you know, after that, and look, there were definitely things that they wouldn't go into, but they did entertain our questions. So we're not talking about, you know, we're not talking about like the worst actors in the market here. You know, the question remained, was that a shadow production forecast cut when they said 50%? Or was that them talking out of both sides of their mouth? See, there's no possibility that we look at that can be good for Danimer in this case. Because if Danimer is saying that, no, all along, we, in a very atypical fashion, like this would be very atypical for the industry, we were talking about the blended output, not the neat PHA output. Well, one of the presentations prior to the de-SPAC, they compared themselves to other PHA producers. And they said, we're the industry leader. And we're twice the size of Kenica. So they showed this slide showing that Danimer's got, double, bar graph, double the capacity of this Japanese company, Kenica. Well, Kenica's number is neat. That's what Kenica has published. That's a neat PHA number. So if Danimer back then was saying, we're twice the size of them, we're the clear market leader, you want to be with us, that was extremely misleading if they knew that their 10 is really a 5 instead, and that they're comparing, they're dead even with Kenica in terms of their capacity. One of the other things that we also seized on was at the time we published Danimer's fairly recent acquisition of a company called Novomer. We look at the Novomer acquisition as a Hail Mary. Danimer went public, raised this money. They're much more developmental stage. It's the case with the more real SPACs that have, companies that have de-SPACed in recent times. The more real ones are just, in general, far riskier, far earlier stage in their development than they've generally admitted. So Danimer, we think, fits that category or that description to a T. So the Novomer acquisition, we think, was effectively an admission that they're not able to solve a number of their production problems that they have with their primary products. What was interesting in their response to us when we talked about the Novomer acquisition, they released some figures that actually imply that Novomer's Renovo is going to be more important than Danimer's own branded PHA. And that's something that we think a lot of investors didn't catch at the time, that whether this was a shadow production cut or not, Danimer's effectively saying, hey, our great PHA that we said so many wonderful things about before and told you is going to dominate the world. And look, by the way, they were talking about a $1 trillion TAM. Ridiculous, but I guess maybe since everybody in SPAC world was doing that sort of thing at the time, maybe they felt it was okay. But
what is the actual TAM that you assume?
No, I mean the thing is bioplastics will have a place, but there's so much more to the story than okay, we can replace everything with these biodegradable plastics. There's a real question as to whether consumer brands actually want to adopt biodegradable plastics, because the problem that you run into is that people start just littering. They're like, oh, this is going to dissolve, and they don't put things in the garbage. And when you think about if you're a consumer brand, selling your potato chips, and your potato chips are showing up all over, the bags are showing up all over the internet as trash, it's not very brand positive. So there's that problem. The holy grail in this whole thing with plastics, we believe, is learning how to recapture the energy that's stored in them. So not so much replacing the hydrocarbon element of plastics, but basically taking the recycling process to this level where you can get that energy back out. Look, obviously there's a problem with plastics in the ocean, microplastics in our body, but bioplastics, PHA bioplastics, it's going to be a niche. It's going to be a small slice of this pie. So when they come out and say, this is a $1 trillion TAM and you know, our PHAs can replace, you know, pretty much every plastic that's used in packaging on the planet. I mean, that's bullshit.
So as you were talking there, Carson, there were two things that really stuck out to me that tend to have popped up in a lot of the short candidates that we've had on the chopping block. One is, you know, some sort of dubious acquisition, whether it's to mask lack of organic growth or to kick the can down the road and going to market in these sort of pre-market early stage technologies. But then as well, these offtake agreements. They're not always called offtake agreements. I think in a lot of the direct lithium names that we've had on here, there is some big name, you know, blue chip stock or a blue chip company that has come out and said, we've made an agreement with them. We're going to buy all the lithium in the world. Once they go to market, they tout it as this great partnership. But really, if you look into it, they're basically saying, if you ever produce a viable product, yeah, in theory, we would work with you.
And what's also important to understand is the greenwashing element here, right? So for these large multinationals, consumer brands in particular, they're under pressure to say these things, to sign agreements. So it used to be, you know, like I used to joke that when we're looking at these like little scammy companies, especially microcaps that are announcing partnerships with large companies, you know, I used to joke that, yeah, man, like we have a corporate Amex, you know, should I say that we're partnered with American Express? I mean, like, I felt like that would be the same standard to which they were holding themselves. But in this case now, the compulsion has really become bilateral. So whereas previously, large company that really doesn't give a fuck about this thing that they just signed to explore some whatever, you know, they would stay silent on, you know, while the little company here promoted the hell out of its stock by issuing all these press releases. That's how it used to be. But when it comes to the, you know, the era of ESG investing, then there is actually an incentive, a significant incentive on the part of the large company, you know, that's like having people stand up at the shareholder meetings and ask, like, what are you doing to, you know, save the planet from, you know, burning, and, you know, whoa, like, look at this agreement we signed with this innovative, you know, company. And it actually, in a way, it really helps when this innovative company that's really like basically a zero in many cases, when that company actually has real market value. You know, it's like everybody kind of benefits from the illusion that this is a really sizable company, or that there are investors who really understand the technology and have bid it up to this level. So everybody benefits from that illusion. You know, it's somewhat of an analog in that regard to a phenomenon that I've learned about and seen numerous times over the years, which is companies that will willingly overpay significantly for an acquisition. And they do it because if they only paid a little bit for the acquisition, then they don't have a great narrative to tell people. But if they pay a lot for it, then they can throw in words like transformational and, you know, yes, this is a, you know, really exciting new direction we're taking the company in. So that's basically the same thing with these large companies signing contracts with companies in the clean tech space, basically.
Well, and as well, that these contracts do have backdoors, which basically allow the companies to void them and to not enforce them. Now, I'm not accusing any of the partners of these companies of doing this knowingly, but if I were playing the cynic, it almost is better for them if the companies are completely non-legitimate, because then they don't have to follow through with the agreement whatsoever. They get all of the PR, they get their narrative, which is what they really want, and they really, there's nothing that they're going to have to change in the future should this company, you know, come through with it, because it's unlikely to happen in the first place.
Right. I mean, a lot of these, you know, contracts are structured either as if you make the product or if you can produce the product according to these specifications, then we will buy it. Or if you can produce the product according to these specifications, we might buy it. You know, so both of those are highly contingent on the company being able to produce the product. And again, like having this, you know, the way that these market caps have been created, it's obviously a result of the monetary conditions that exist in the world and, you know, and just the dysfunctions around markets. But these large market caps give the illusion that the technology must be reasonably well developed. You know, it's this cognitive dissonance that investors have, you know, between knowing that they're paying a lot, but, you know, not having actually really understood whether to what extent the technology exists. You know, you pull out a potato chip bag and like, look, it exists. And that was basically something that Danimer did. Danimer has developed, they co-developed a bag with Pepsi made from a different type of bioplastic called PLA, which is much more common, has a lot of issues. So it's very limited use cases for PLA. And Danimer doesn't actually make the PLA, it just blends it. So they purchase it from elsewhere. So they're holding up this Pepsi, you know, potato chip bag that they co-developed. And, you know, they didn't really, you had to actually do your research outside of Danimer materials to realize that's not PHA bag, it's a PLA bag.
Yeah, it's like maybe the EV companies where they say that they're doing all this manufacturing and there is a truck, you know, there is a car that they end up making, but they're putting in seats. They're not actually fully manufacturing this thing in the same way they're leading on to believe. So lots of analogs in the short world in terms of targets and how they seem to align even across these very disparate industries. Obviously, this was one that you've already told us that you closed out. I would just like to get it on the record. Are you still short, Baker?
Yes.
All right. Well, Carson, thank you for coming back on the block. I look forward to doing this a lot more with you and the other guests who have come on the chopping block recently.
Cool. Look forward to 2022. I mean, all right. That's 2022, not 2022.